So, but anyways, so they obviously heard this thing coming up the hill, and they're standing back by the woodpile in pitch black. And like I say, he was getting ready to leave, and he goes, "I'm just going to stand back there for a while and listen." And sure as heck, I mean, I'm getting a text. He goes, "There's footfalls coming."
At which point, what, he's texting me.
Yeah. What? And he goes, "What should I do?" And I'm like, "Well, hold your ground." I go, "As long as you feel comfortable, hold your ground." And he said they just sat there and just talked quietly, and they could keep hearing closer, louder and louder. And he said, finally, he goes, "Man, we're losing. I'm scared to death." I said,
"Sasquatch is a podcast about Bigfoot. It's recorded for the skeptics, the believers, the so-called knowers, and those who just have a casual interest in the subject." Information, visit sasquatch.com.
Oh, watching the show In Search Of back in the late 70s, early 80s. My grandfather always watched it every Friday as a ritual, and we always went over there and spent time with them. And so we happened to have an episode with Leonard Nimoy talking about Sasquatch in British Columbia, and it fascinated me.
So that just followed you into your old age?
Pretty much. I mean, that pretty much after seeing that episode, I went to Hilliard Elementary in Westlake, Ohio, and went to the library, asked the librarian if they had books on myths and legends and Indian folklore, and she took me over to the area, and sure as heck, there was books about
Bigfoot. It's about 11:30 in the morning when I was recording this, and I'm in the woods with Mark DeWorth from the Ohio Bigfoot Conference and the BFRO, and Mark Mazel of the BFRO as well. We're in the Mohican State Park at this point. We're actually on the Lions Falls Trail into the history of that area in a little.
Keep going.
I don't know if I believe you. How did you get hooked up with Don?
With Keating? Don?
Yeah.
Well, when I met my wife, who is my wife now, she invited me to a family reunion in 1989 down in...
For those uninitiated in Ohio Bigfoot lore, Don Keating is the investigator who's kind of the godfather of Bigfoot research in Ohio. He's also the founder of the Ohio Bigfoot Conference. So he is usually credited with really kicking off research in the state of Ohio.
Meeting the family, I mean, my Bigfoot meter turned on again. And I started thinking to myself, wow, Ohio has this kind of woods and terrain. There has to be some kind of Bigfoot folklore of some sort down here.
Don, where did you come in?
Well, when staying at the farm at this family reunion, I had asked Uncle Bob if he had heard of any stories of any strange animal reports. And he asked me, he goes, "What do you mean, like cougars, bears?" I go, "Yeah, stuff like that, or anything out of the norm." And he goes, "Yeah, we have our share of Black Panther stories and bear stories." He goes, "But the neighbor down the road swears he saw a bear walk across State Route 800 and step over a guardrail." And when he said that, I caught my interest immediately, and I just kind of shunned up. And then later that evening at dinner, Aunt Betty goes, "Oh, I heard Bob told you about the neighbor seeing the bear walk across the road. Would you like to go meet him?" I'm like, "Yes." Well, the following day was my first interview ever.
Don.
Well, after interviewing the guy and him telling me the bear was standing on the side of the road to the left, stepped across the road in 2.5 steps and stepped over the guardrail, he goes, "I never knew a bear could do that." I was like amazed, so I went back to the car where Aunt Betty was waiting, and I get in the car, she's in there smoking like a fiend, and she looks over at me and she goes, "What do you think he saw?" And I looked at her and I said, "What do you think he saw?" And she goes, "Bigfoot, no doubt." I said, "Bingo, you said it first." So then she mentioned about Don Keating. She goes, "Would you like to go meet him?" So we drove right to Newcomerstown through the back roads, came in over the Tuscarora River, right in the backside of Newcomerstown, went to a library, got his phone number and called him. He wasn't there, left a message, but then I called him later that night, and he was telling me about all these Bigfoot reports in Ohio, and I was amazed, caught totally off guard, and so on. So that's how I met Don.
When was this, like, what year?
1989.
Okay, 89. So a lot of people think that Bigfoot in Ohio is like a fairly new phenomenon, especially people that aren't in the state. What do you say to that?
Well, it's not new. It's just that the people back in the 60s and 70s that were potentially seeing these things even then, they didn't report it because they were fear of ridicule, fear of harassment, and they kept their stories to themselves because there wasn't a good outlet, like, say, the BFRO is today, or other organizations to report these sightings to.
Also with us in the woods today was Mark Mazel, who is one of the lead investigators for the BFRO in Ohio. He is also tasked with heading up most expeditions within the state that the BFRO conducts, and he is employed in the medical field somewhere in Summit County, not far from one of my favorite hangouts, the Cuyahoga Valley National Park.
Mark, can you introduce yourself and who you are, because I didn't get any of that.
Mark Mazel, investigator with the BFRO for the last decade.
How did you get into this?
I was 10 years old 40 years ago, and I had a teacher that brought in newspaper articles, and also it was the time just after PG film, In Search Of, and of course the $6 million Man.
Have you had a sighting?
Nothing that I would call a sighting. I've had quite a few Class Bs. I've seen something through a thermal that I thought was a deer, and it stood up on two legs and walked away in a spot that was 5.5 miles in and out, and there were no people over there. I've had what they call eye shine from about 100, 125 feet. More rocks than I can ever count. One of my expedition teams has recorded, according to Ron Moorhead, what he thinks is a Squatch. It's in his last book, Voices of the Wilderness. And just quite a few other, you know, finding prints.
Oh, that's Voices in the Night. That's a good
thing. You gonna fire him?
No, he gets to walk home.
I'll just diplomatic immunity his vehicle or his vehicle.
His vehicle, yeah. So
that'll be an easy guy.
So yeah, so since I was like 10, I've been into this.
How did you get hooked up with, how did you get stuck with Mark?
Oh, we've known each other since, what, 2005?
Yeah, something like, he was when he used to come to the conference, people growl and snarl.
BFROs.
You didn't wear BFRO back then, that was a bad word.
I had an initial swing in the BFRO even before he was in it, and I helped pretty much help clean up this. If you would have seen how many reports were in there, thousands of them. And I worked for a couple years on this, and when my daughter died, I told him, you know what, I know I've been doing all this, but I just can't do this right now, so I basically just kind of took a hiatus, and they kept me in, but I never, like, they would send me the forms to fill, we have paperwork, if I never signed, she kept sending me, you know, emails with it, and then finally, after getting back in and going back full swing again, because, you know, I always like being in the woods anyway, so it just was natural to, and I'm always interested in this, so, and then, you know, I went back to helping Don with the conferences again. And
Mohican State Park and adjoining state forest have almost 6,000 acres. The Clear Fork branch of the Mohican River runs through it as well. The Mohican River is one of the clearest rivers in the state. For the last few years, it's been a sighting hotbed with multiple eyewitnesses claiming to see Bigfoot roaming throughout the park. You'll see some of the sighting reports in the Ohio Bigfoot episode of Finding Bigfoot. The park's located about 2 hours from Salt Fork State Park, where every year the Ohio Bigfoot Conference has been held for quite some time.
Ohio Bigfoot Conference. Well, I was helping Don for years with the annual Bigfoot Conference every year, and when he decided to get out after the 2012 event, he asked me to take over the event. Or actually, it would be the 2011 event. So I'll let me rephrase that. After he was getting out after the 2011 event, he asked me to take over. And at first I told him no, he wasn't giving me enough ample time. And then rumors were another group was trying to go in and take the event. So and so he called me and let me know. And I said, well, you know what, if it's that important, I'll do it, even though I only had 3 months to prepare for it. So I hosted the Ohio Bigfoot Conference, which I changed it to from the annual Bigfoot Conference. And 2012 was at the Barber Civic Center in Cambridge, Ohio. And then the following years, it's 13 and 14 has been at Salt Fork, and 15 and 16 will be at Salt Fork.
In your opinion, what is the best argument in favor of Bigfoot?
Well, I mean, aside from the Patterson film, which is definitely a female Sasquatch, no doubt about it,
as all the not only the physical evidence and the track casts, if the dermal ridge casts are very compelling, the mid-tarsal break theory is very compelling. And but like it goes to anything. In a court of law, if there's a witness, one witness is telling the truth, that can convict someone. Well, if one witness is telling the truth about what they've actually seen, that means there's some credence to go ahead and investigate more. Mm-hmm. So we're talking thousands and thousands, and you might have more of the sheer numbers because you're more of a data person on how many reports are out there that are actually where you could read about them. There's probably thousands and thousands and thousands of them. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, even in that, even if you only take 10% of being 100% legit, you're still in the hundreds and even close to thousands. Mm-hmm.
Do you think there's a good argument against it?
Let's just say this. You know, people can argue all they want, and I understand the scientific end of it, and I understand that the body is what's going to prove it and everything, but you know what? A lot of the argument is just for argument's sake. It's just to start controversy. It's because a lot of people, especially in the scientific community, a lot of them don't want the change. If this thing becomes a known animal, that's going to throw a kink in all the theories of how primates evolved, how humans evolved, and vice versa. And, you know, I'm not sure, is this a hominid? Is it a hominoid? Is it a primate? It's hard to say. But it's walking on two legs. If it's walking on two legs, it has a much larger brain because it needs the bigger brain for bipedal locomotion. And, you know, so I lean toward Aurelia hominid. But in terms of the argument against it, it's just for people to have fun with it. I mean, people are going to do it just to try to deter and try to get people upset. You're more than welcome not to believe. And, you know, I always tell people, keep your skepticals on. Mm-hmm. Don't believe everything you read. Don't believe everything someone says. You just got to be a judge. Make your own case. It's simple.
Habitat in Ohio, you think it could support it?
Oh, heck yeah. We have a huge watershed to the north, a huge watershed to the south, the Ohio River. We have the Finger Lakes and the whole eastern part, which basically has over a dozen large size reservoirs, you know, dammed up rivers and things like that. We have massive, we have north and south drainage in the state in terms of river flow. And we have a huge white-tailed deer population. Huge white-tailed deer population, huge turkey population, lack of natural predators. It's not like there's herds of cougars or wolves running around helping to control. Bigfoots fit in this niche perfectly. Yeah. And if you really think about it, eastern Ohio is the foothills of the Allegheny Mountains. So any animal that's going to come feed for the highest nutrition is going to be at the base of the mountains or the beginning of the foothills, because that's where things grow. Plus the agriculture alone, between corn, soybean, and different things that are planting. Northeast Ohio is all fruit-bearing trees. There's everything's there.
So are you in, you're not in a migratory camp, or you are in a migratory, or do you just think they move a lot?
I think they're nomadic, because Okay. Nomadic leads to success. Mm-hmm. You know, you come through an area, and guess what? There's a subdivision. You're not going to lose any sleep over it. Guess what? You just don't come back anymore. Where, for example, a large predator like a bear or a grizzly, you put a subdivision in its lair, guess what it's going to do? Kill till it gets killed. It's that simple. Mm-hmm. It doesn't flee. That's why it's so easy to track them, so easy to kill them.
What do you say to the people, because I just had this conversation with my grandfather-in-law. He told me that he doesn't think they could exist in the eastern portion of the states, but he believes they could be out in like British Columbia. Where do you think the argument comes from that they can exist in one place but not another?
Because since he's old school, notice I said old school, you know, he was watching all those shows in the 60s and 70s that talked about apes in British Columbia, apes in Canada, apes in the Pacific Northwest, big mountain ranges. And when you watch TV and they funneled that information, if that's the only place these things exist, you know, that's going to give the credence that that there can't be anywhere else. Plus, back if you think about it, in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, most of the East Coast was deforested, I mean, or being mined, so there wasn't a lot of the habitat. It wasn't until the 50s and 60s when the mining stopped and they started replanting, reclaiming land, and building watersheds and things like that.
When would that have been?
When would what be?
Well, I'm really interested in the absence of reports between, say, 40, it seems like, and maybe the mid to late 60s?
Well, that was all this big they were just taking the natural resources out of all these lands. Gas wells were being installed. Shale, clay, everything they could take out of here. Coal, because everything was running off coal. So they would go into a place like this and just whoosh, every tree gone.
So that could have conceivably been
They were driven.
Point, okay.
Yeah, they were driven. It wasn't until everything, the ecosystem started recovering and things were growing in, when deer and other things come in, the squatches from Canada and from different parts of where there were some isolated forests started moving and expanding back
okay,
in.
Okay, so that could explain why then we start seeing reports again in the late 60s.
Yeah, of course.
To expand on what Mark was saying, mm-hmm. as far as the late 60s and all that, you have to look at the decreased use of DDT and the pesticides. They started changing the pesticides, which brought back bald eagles. Bald eagles were gone in Ohio, and now there's a nesting pair in every county in Ohio. Mm-hmm. So with the use of DDT, the reclaiming of the land, also the big agriculture coming in, small mom-and-pop farms couldn't compete. They've gone back to fowl. 30, 40 years ago, they were farms. Now, they're young forests. Mm-hmm. In 1908, Ohio had 8% forest. As of today, it's about 48%.
Yep.
And we're talking along the eastern side, and the south is where most of the forest. In northwest Ohio, there's pockets of it, but that's where the big chicken farms, pig farms, and the agricultural firms work out of in Ohio.
Right.
So, you know, you look at that and combined with the other thing, there were reports in the 40s, but they were pockets.
Okay.
You know, you look at certain areas. You look at Salt Fork today. In 1960, that was all...
He knows I hate Salt Fork.
Yeah, but it was all agriculture. It was a lot of sheep farming and everything else. It wasn't until the state started claiming through selling out eminent domain that came back. But even before that, in the 50s, there were reports coming out of the Salt Fork area of something because the foothills further to the east where farming wasn't quite as successful.
Mm-hmm.
So you look at it. Also, you have to go back to the old growth. There's not much old growth left in Ohio. Part of it's the Emerald Necklace in Cleveland. That's part of the original forest still left in Ohio because of planters left it that way. But most of the other, there's a few pockets within Ohio that have the old growth forest. If you go back and you look
it's
at that.
It's really not old growth, though. It's first generation. All the old growth were the true old growth. Because, you know, Ohio had trees they have on record,
big as
redwoods around. I mean, some of the species of trees. There used to be so many hardwood trees.
It depends on classification of old growth, too. Because 300, some guys say 300 years and older is old growth, right?
There's some 300-year trees in Ohio.
Yeah.
If you go to some of the strip mine areas, and one thing you'll notice is you'll be going through and they'll have these little peasley, little wimp trees, you know, kind of maybe the size of this one here, and then all of a sudden you'll notice maybe one over here, one over there, massive old oak, maple, whatever. And you know what those were there for? Because they used them as guides for the truckers when they would be bringing the coal out at night. And help with the soil. So they would follow, drive there, make the right, drive to the next one, make the right, and so on. So if you go down, what you guys need to do, especially for your book, if you're going to use any of this for your book.
So in case anyone's wondering what Mark is talking about, or I'm talking about, if we mention the book, in quotes, throughout this interview, it's the fact that Mark Maskey and I are working on a book about the Ohio Bigfoot. Hopefully it'll be done in the next year or so. A lot of this interview is going to be used in the book, which is why there's so much about the geography and topography and possible habitat for Bigfoot in Ohio.
Strip mines and everything else like that. And the theory is that we get up minerals that they need. We make it easy. They come into areas. If you look at a lot of reports, you're looking at water, multi-use land, which that's what I call area like this, where you have pockets of forest and farms on the periphery that they can get to, and then quarries or somewhere where they strip mine.
Like you Woodbury Strip Pond Heaven. Mm-hmm. There's over 200 little ponds in there. Think about it. Those were all, a lot of those were coal
that's
washing
surface,
ponds.
That's surface mining or
They were doing all sorts of surface mining, but they would clean the coal in these ponds. Well, when the ODNR reclaimed it, part of the thing was cleaning the water up. And in most cases, there's a few sulfur ponds there, but in most cases, that's very clean water now because it's been 50 years.
Right. Yeah.
So, I mean, and you know your research into Roscoe. Well, Roscoe's just south of there.
Yeah.
I mean, the Roscoe area is kind of close to Wood, very close to Woodbury.
Yeah, right there.
So all those historical reports, mm-hmm. you know, and then they started mining and then they kind of went away. Then all of a sudden, they started picking up in the late 70s, early 80s again. And then in the 90s, there were just tons of reports out. So.
Are there reports at strip mines or surface mining or whatever where they haven't reforested it, or is it pretty much?
It all depends on what's near it.
Okay.
There's reports for a while there. Is it no Belmont County? Just
Jefferson.
No, just east of Salt Fork. I was getting reports in this crossroad area coming down. What's that? The other lake up there, is that Tappan or is it Clendenning?
You're thinking Clendenning or Clendenning. Piedmont?
No, Piedmont. It was Piedmont. Yeah. Piedmont. The Squatch would come down and it was going through property and this area back and forth, and it was always coming between the Piedmont area where it would be seen, and then all the way down to this quarry area, which happened to have a farm right next to it too. Mm-hmm. So double bonus.
And probably the quarry too is probably pure fresh water, because we have quarries in Ohio, like in Amherst, and I know those are the ones I know about. That I mean, if you test the water, it's better than what comes out of our tap.
Well, hell, they got one of those in the Cauga Valley there.
Yeah. Well, in Salt Fork too, yeah. They have that actual. It's tapped into the side of the road, and people come and fill their bottles.
I drink every time I'm there.
Really.
Huh. Yeah, in the back end of Freedom Road.
Come in the back side. You'll see the spigot coming out of the... It just keeps running.
It flows, always.
And then people come and bring their gallons, and then they sell it.
Mm-hmm. There's no... there were coal mines, but they were, like, actual...
Strip mines, mostly, in Ohio.
Right, but there were some down in, like, Guernsey, right?
No, eastern Powhatan, along that Ohio River Valley.
That's the reason I'm asking is, like, this is what I'm writing. This is what I was working on yesterday in the geography section, was all the strip mine, surface mine areas, and why... We have so many sightings around there? Because, like, Minerva Monster revolves around. Right around that strip mine. Mm-hmm.
They said it would go into the water and swim underneath, and supposedly there was, like, an underwater shaft.
Well, you know what we got? Well, Barbara's the one that did the story for the beacon. She told me, did you ever hear about that? She thought it was, like, a jaw or a leg bone or something she found down in near the strip mine, and they sent it off to Malone, and Malone lost it.
Oh, yeah, I've heard that. Yeah,
she's the one that found it.
Yeah. She's, take photos of it?
I don't know. She's supposedly going to try to get me the information she's got on it, but I think I'm going to actually have to go down to the Akron Library to get, like, copies of their paper.
As far as he says nomadic, I disagree.
Okay, go into that.
Because I think it's more of a range. The question is, how big of a range is it? A range can look nomadic if you're looking at an animal that you get footprints, and Cliff Berrickman and I were just talking about this last week, where you're getting footprints over of the same individual 60 to 70 miles away from each other. So the question becomes, how big is that range, and can that range be nomadic? Where Mark was saying, if somebody builds it up, sure, they just take that out of their circuit, but if you start watching reports for years, there seems to be a little circuit that areas heat up and they cool down. This area we're in right now, for 5 years, up until 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, there was nothing. And then all of a sudden, it blew up.
Yeah.
All right, now we're
still... Did something get eliminated? Was it because of, the fracking? They're going into areas that probably never saw human traffic for years. All of a sudden, they're driving a bulldozer up, unseats them.
So they move around. See, the other thing is that the possibility, when we talk about the less use of pesticides and stuff and the reclamation of land... Animals are becoming healthy. Results. You have prey animals, you get apex predators. So the question then becomes, is their population expanding? And when population expands, you know, young males
get pushed
out, in theory. And are they going to establish new territory? Could this what's happened here in the Mohican area?
That's what I think.
How big is a mountain gorilla's range? It's like, it's pretty big, right?
Mountain gorilla's age isn't as big as you think, because they rely on a certain types of food source, and those food sources are pocketed in Africa. You should talk to Esteban. He'll go on the show for you. To get back to what he was saying about, you know, the nomadic, I mean, and if it's a territorial thing, it's a massive territory. It's not this little 40 square mile.
So what do you think it is, then?
I think it's a range. The question is, how big is the range? Is it 60 miles by 60 miles, which is 3,600 square miles?
Yeah.
Or even bigger. I mean, 60 miles to 60 miles. And then when you talk about breeding and to prevent inbreeding and genetic viability, something here in the Mohican area might travel up or travel down.
Try to find a suitable mate, a female.
Or from here to Woodbury, and Woodbury over to Salt Fork and the pockets where things happen. So, you know, that's the question. Do they move around, you know? How do they communicate with that and say, hey, we're here, and find each other? I mean, that's partially what, like, the Ohio Howl, I think, was. Is that, in my opinion, it's a locator howl.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard those in the Cauga Valley, where it's just a broadcast trail, and it's like, you know, I'm here, answer.
I think what we're going to find out is, like, there's going to be a time when all this what I call pre-field work, because we're pretty much like the what do you want to call it, the Oh, the, what am I, I'm trying to think. I gotta,
sexy.
No, my uncle used to call it in roofing, the person that did all the hard work, the
plebeian.
Yeah, something like that. You know, basically we're doing all the hard work. Now we're laying the foundation, because what's going to happen is when one of these, say, one day there's one laying dead and it's found, it's documented and everything like that, people like us, they're going to take us over to that bridge over there and have a big ribbon cutting ceremony. And when we walk across,
we're done.
Boom, goodbye. Guarantee
academics
you.
Will take over.
Take right over, exactly.
There might be some positions, because as they learn it, you know, what you're talking about, they'll read some of the things that we've written or talked about.
And they'll hire you to take them in.
As a guide, and after that, they'll say, no, this is ours.
You know, when you go to use the key card, it won't work. What's going on? Mm-hmm. What's going on?
As you can tell, this conversation was kind of all over the place. One of the things I always like to ask anyone who comes on the show is what they think of chatter and vocalizations, just because I find it such an interesting part of the topic. And it's so obtuse and hard to tell what the sounds actually belong to. So I decided to ask Mark and Mark what they thought of that.
The howls, I mean, is it just...
You don't hear much samurai chatter here in the East, and I can only speak in the East.
Okay.
You get more of the location howls, like the Ohio howl, and you'll get some other whoops and different things like that. Ohio has, and even this area has howls, you know, with having friends up in Michigan that record, or even West Virginia. I had an investigator in the BFRO question a howl that I placed with one of my reports. He goes, they don't make that sound. I go, yes, they do. I've heard it for years. He goes, no. And then a year ago, he comes up to me and goes, oh, I got one of those in Virginia. I was wrong. So I'm like, yeah. So, you know, how the vocalization's not so much the samurai chair. The question is, what are they trying to communicate? Nobody knows for sure. We put our human spin, human emotion on it and all that. So we interpret that as what we think it is, but nobody knows for sure.
Mm-hmm. Is that a signal bar?
No? I don't. I don't
think so.
Crap, now I forget what I was about to ask.
I'm roaming, but I do...
There's sightings inside this park, though, right? Inside Mohican?
Yes.
What, can you tell me any of those?
Well, people Blade is leading. Mm-hmm. Robin's had one in here. Most of the sightings currently that have been going on around here are the corridor to the west and to the east of Mohican. Maybe they're coming in here, but they're being seen further to the east and further west, a little easier to travel than through this stuff, and also the multi-use land going from plot to plot, whatever, raiding farms or garbage can, who knows.
Mm-hmm.
So, but not so much in the park. You hear a few things, you know, no official reports through the BFR, but when you build up contacts, people call you and say, hey, you know, Wally Road near here, there was some stuff, which actually is over that way, thinking about it, which is just the other side of the park, you know. Going on, so that they have to go somewhere, and this park actually provides.
Guys, I'm doing an interview. Yeah?
Who's saying your phone was garbage?
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
You're not. I'm just laughing. But this park actually offers, if you look at this park, the one thing, you have the trails, but, you know, it statistically, 99% of the people don't leave a trail within a quarter mile of it. Even a deer hunter doesn't go a quarter mile off because they don't want to drag a deer that far off. So you have habitat in here where I guarantee you most people don't go. So if you want a place to hang out that's safe, this is part of it that comes to the park. But the park seems to be the nexus. The reports have come from either side of through the corridors. So could they be coming in here, or is it, we don't know.
Do you think these things are, and you guys can both chime in, but do you think these things are malevolent or just wild animals? Do you think they're mean? Because the new thing right now seems to be that people love talking about, like, getting attacked by Bigfoot. So
if they got attacked by Bigfoot,
they wouldn't
be
there
here
to tell the story.
Okay.
So, you know, I won't go as far as David Politi's book, Missing 411. I don't necessarily. I think that's ancillary evidence at best. As far as being attacked, I've come across and had these animals vocalize at me, and they didn't sound happy, and I've had rocks that are up to a foot wide go by me. Now, does that mean that that's trying to attack me? No, I took it more as an intimidation factor kind of thing. But it, like any other thing, good days, bad days, everything else, you know. They're curious. If they want to play, they'll play.
Mm-hmm. If you piss one of them off, you get close to one of their young ones, I'm sure they're going to drive your ass out of there.
And they do.
And there's plenty of stories of witnesses saying that the thing's coming after them. Well, what happened next? Well, I fell. Well, what happened? Well, I turned around and the Bigfoot's standing there, waiting. They get up, it's like herding chickens or herding sheep.
Or they'll draw you off.
Yeah.
There's other things, and I've had this happen with people. It's never happened to me, but people I know, where the squatch will actually stop and have you follow them. And my first question is so what's going on at a 45-degree angle that way?
Mm-hmm.
Why is it pulling you a certain way and stopping? Because it wants you to
you
go.
Remember Jason's story at the town hall?
Yeah.
Well, Jason said that they could hear it coming in. Well, the whole time this is happening, which he didn't, he's texting me right then. He's like, things kind of, he was panicking through the text, you know, and so he goes, it's coming. He goes, now it stopped and we can see it. We can see the outline of it. And I said, just so you know, there's more than one.
Yeah.
And he said, when I said that, he said his stomach went into his throat.
Actually, the recap was that we got a report coming from the Belmont area of a family having stuff happen. Mark called Jason and said, Jason, come out to go take a look at the property for us. And, he went out there once before where this cabin, it's a neglected cabin, the family was having sightings. There was a father, a wife, a daughter, and a grandchild living there.
Two grandkids.
And the one daughter came almost from here to the tree, which is only, 10 feet, 15 mm-hmm. feet away?
Yeah.
Where it came up when she was doing some painting one day, and it was looking at her.
She just heard something off to her left. She stood up. She was painting a bench. She was in his position mm-hmm. with her back to the wood pile. When she stood up and looked, right there, just watch her in broad daylight. And she basically just hauled ass into the house. Well, the property owner, she is a landscaper and does a lot of business type landscaping and high end landscaping. Well, she says, well, with my job, a lot of times I don't get home to get to work in my own yard. So she catches herself being out in the yard working on her flowers. It's getting dark. She said, well, when they first moved into that family property, because that was within the family, she was working in the yard, and she said she heard something, this loud thump thump thump, coming closer and closer. She turned around and it was dark, and she could see, you know, something was coming, but it was a distance away, so she just got up and ran into the ran up on the deck and jumped through the cabin door.
Jumped through the door?
Jumped, basically, ripped the screen open, just jumped right in.
She said she could
hear it go by, and she could even feel the as it went by. Well, she didn't know what it was, had no clue. Well, it wasn't until one day she was taking a bag of garbage out. She had forgotten the house. She had just taken garbage out. She went back a second time, got garbage, came back out the same gate, and they had their pickup truck parked there in the driveway, on the dirt gravel driveway, that she happened to look up, and there's a Bigfoot standing behind the truck looking at her, kind of a dark brownish, reddish creature. Well, she dropped the bag and ran like hell. Don't say I told her husband. And
remind me of that.
And by the time he came out, it was obviously gone. But well, what we found out was, well, what the hell are they coming in the driveway for? Well, what it is, every Sunday, they after church, they have this get together where all their friends come over. They all bring dishes, have this big cookout. So any food that's left over, they just kept tossing down the edge of the driveway that goes down to the base of the hollow. Well, guess what? These things are coming up. Well, they said the critters would come up to get the food. Well, guess what? They were getting more than coons and cats and other things. And these squatches were coming up. And I feel that there's two of them. I feel there's a female and a small one, because they found not only the large tracks, which you've seen the casts of,
mm-hmm.
but they've actually had small tracks casted too, coming up the hillside, going after the food.
This sounds really, it sounds really similar to the Minerva thing, because they had that,
You hear that story often. I mean, I've done a report up in Auburn near Ladue Reservoir where the people just threw the food out back, and then one day the cat disappeared, and another day the...
sure wasn't Chinese?
Yeah. Not in Auburn.
Okay. Tastes like chicken.
They come out there, and wherever they throw the food, there's something looking at them. I mean, we did a report, actually, when I first met Mark in Ashland County, not far from here, where they would throw the food out into the wood pile.
Yeah.
Or not the wood pile, but the compost area, and squatches. What river was that? It's right on a river. I don't remember what river it was. Well,
before we go any further, though, Jason's sighting, he was down there investigating and just
mm-hmm.
saw it.
Yeah, basically what happened, I pre-interviewed my witness, and after talking with her multiple times and hearing more and more about this stuff, and I said, this lady sounds very credible. So what I typically do down in these areas where we have these real long reaches, I always tell Mark and other BFRO guys, don't let's not drive 200 miles because we could have another one of those incidents where it's the wackos. Mm-hmm. So Jason, because he lives down there and he knows everyone, his family's well known, these people are going to talk to him because, well, I know who your father is. Oh, yeah, great guy, you know. So they become more relaxed. Well, he's a principal for a school, so he's used to dealing with kids and everything. And people, so he went down there and talked with her, and he interviewed the young 4-year-old that claimed, kept telling Grandma and Grandpa one night they're watching TV in their family room because they had monkeys looking in the window. Well, Grandma and Grandpa, they're too busy watching TV, and the kid kept saying that, so they just closed the shade because they wanted him to be quiet to watch their show, didn't think anything of it. Well, the next day, when they went out, they found tracks on the side of the driveway. So then she pulled the little kid out and says, what did you see? I said, oh, it was a monkey, and it was looking in the window. Well, Jason interviewed the 4-year-old without Grandma being away and got him comfortable because his knowledge of working with kids. And, and the little kid says, oh, yeah, how close was it to you? And he's like, oh, the kid's like, oh, between me and you, that's how close. Well, where was it standing? Oh, just right there. So I went outside. Well, his friend did, because we reenacted it when I was there too. And literally, it was probably from here to him is where the wall of the house is. So the creature was just standing there looking in. And he said it was all way up on the window. And so on. So, and then, of course, you know, the witness obviously recounted her sighting, and then the daughter showed up and recounted what she was working, painting at the wood pile. And then the wood pile ended up being pushed knocked in. And when I say wood pile, and Mark can tell you, you'd have to be 10 foot tall on the backside to even get your head over the top. Yeah. Whatever, and this is a huge, and just in. Hmm. And so we suggested to reset it up, see what happens.
Unfortunately, they changed the parameters there.
Yep.
Okay, but Jason's sighting was like he saw this thing over the truck too, right?
Mm-hmm. Him and another investigator, because I always tell any people we send out, we always say you have to go with another person. Right. We don't want to send you alone or anything like that. You know, so for example, you could take Matsky with you, and if it looks bad, you just kick him to the ground and go. Definitely. Simple.
But,
you have to look out for yourself, Seth.
So. I know, I understand.
And so one day, if we're at the bridge and I'm holding on, just let go.
All right.
And so they obviously heard this thing coming up the hill, and they're standing back by the woodpile in pitch black. And like I say, he was getting ready to leave, and he goes, I'm just going to stand back there for a while and listen. And sure as heck, I mean, I'm getting a text. He goes, there's footfalls coming.
At which point he's texting me.
Yeah. He goes, what should I do? And I'm like, well, hold your ground. I go, as long as you feel comfortable, hold your ground. And he said they just sat there and just talked quietly, and they could keep hearing closer and closer and closer. I mean, louder and louder. And he said, finally, he goes, man, we're losing. I'm scared to death. I go, is there anywhere you can go sit down a little farther away? He goes, well, there's a porch back on the old cabin. So I said, go sit up there and sit and watch. Well, sure as heck, they went up there, and the whole time they went up there, they could hear the footfalls coming and coming. And, well, there was a couple of instances where there's big opening between two trees. It was a real moonlit night, and you could see light in the background of the trees. He says, all of a sudden, you see this silhouette go between the two trees, and it starts going like this, just swaying back and forth. And him and his friend were staring at it, and he's telling me, you know, this thing's looking at us, or whatever. And I said, beware, there's probably a second one. They typically will get you to freeze on one, and the other one does the old loop-de-doo. Mm-hmm. Sure as heck, his buddy, you know, like I say, taps him on the shoulder, says, look toward the... He has a Cadillac Escalade, full-side SUV, and the thing's head's leaning up over, back down, up over, down, watching them. And he says, that's it. I'll call you later. He goes, I lost it. He was falling apart. But so the funny thing is for poor Jason is, you know, here he gets sent on maybe about the third little chore I've had him do, and he has this incident. So now he's like, he's blown away. Mm-hmm. So now, and I'm worried that he's going to think that it's going to be always that easy.
Hopefully you enjoyed this episode. Big thanks goes out to Mark DeWorth and Mark Mazel for allowing me to interview them while we were out hiking. And a big thanks goes out to all those that were involved in the Squatch Fest event that this took place at. If you're looking for more information on Mark Mazel or Mark DeWorth, you can find their profiles and some of the reports they've investigated on the BFRO site. Join the conversation at facebook.com/sasswhat. Find us on Twitter by using the hashtag sasswhat, or you can find me on Twitter at Seth Breeds Love. Mark Matsky is on Twitter at Reverend Matsky. Send your letters to sasswhatmail@gmail.com and leave us a rating and review on iTunes.